as
once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English day.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of the Personal Wealth Coach on this January 19th, 2019. The only 1-19-19 that you're going to experience in your lifetime.
We just broke a record, by the way.
We did?
Big one, yeah.
Was it 33 RBM?
No, it's a big record. This is a record that's never even been broken before.
Was it the
today is the first time in the history of the world that we've been alive on this day.
That's true.
It's a big record.
We're also in the
it's huge. We're breaking records every second for the entire foreseeable future.
For the government shutdown, we're breaking records. See, this is the longest government shutdown in history.
It is.
In the history of the United States.
Yeah.
And we have a caller on 254-773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, guys, follow-up question. John Bogle died this week. Can you kind of just give a history of his impact on the investing community? And I'll hang up and listen.
Thank you. All right. That's a good question. You want me to start it, and then I'll hand it over to you?
Whatever you want to do.
His number one impact, his number one influence on investors in general has been about the cost of investments. He brought down the average cost of being in a mutual fund tremendously, and that we can aim it right at him. He also invented the index fund.
About 15 years ago, the average cost of a mutual fund was 1.4%. It's now 0.54% in the United States.
And that's attributable
mainly in
large part to his pushes.
Well, perhaps.
I mean, there's a market force. Cheaper is better. And people, when they have the option of going cheaper, it's better. But it's kind of like Sam Walton. We can attribute a lot of the price drops that we saw in the 1980s and 90s in products to Sam Walton.
John Bogle founded Vanguard. Vanguard, which is an excellent company. It is in effect owned by, it's in effect non, it's not organized as a nonprofit technically, but it is a nonprofit. It's owned by their,
if
you're a mutual fund shareholder in a Vanguard fund, you are effectively an owner of the company. Now, let me say, with all the praise that I have read this week, and I have read a lot of praise this week for John Bogle, I will also
as
say
you should have praise in the week of one's death. Let's wait till next week to say any negatives.
No, let's just put out what he said were negatives.
Sure. Okay.
And there's not a lot being said about that, and that he was deeply concerned in the months before his death.
Right. He published a lot about this.
About two things. One, that index funds were becoming dangerous. They own, depending on how you want to look at them, between 15 and 37% of the stocks in the United States. And one of the reasons the stock market is very distorted right now based on underlying value, and one of the reasons it's very distorted is because of the S&P 500 index funds, and he found the first one and he started the wave of that. He also was deeply concerned about ETFs and thought they were counterproductive.
Yeah.
And so it's good to remember that even though he founded the first index fund, he put caveats around it.
Right.
And the index funds, if you don't have a clue about the market and you want to invest in the market, an index fund is not a bad idea. But when the mass of people, the mass of new money goes into the index funds, then what happens is the highest price, particularly the S&P 500 index funds, the highest priced stocks tend to become more highly priced, and the lower priced stocks tend to get more and more ignored. And that is where the market is right now, by the way.
Yeah, and you can see that by looking at market movements recently. They've been kind of across all aspects of the market. Not all the profitable companies continue to be upper priced, and lower profits get lower priced, and so on. And I have an analogy that I'm going to throw out there, and then I'll step out for a second. The analogy is that an index is supposed to be a measurement tool. That's why it's called index. It's a measurement tool that's published by media companies, Bloomberg's, S&P, originally the Dow indexes were the Wall Street Journal, so Dow Jones Corporation. And the purpose was to say what's happening out there, kind of like your rain gauge. And or like the paint on the side of the pool saying how deep the water is, or the flood markers on the low water crossing. You've got a sign that has measurements on there, and that is not part of the water. The sign is its own thing. If you think of an old coffee pot, this is the analogy. The old coffee pot where you pour, there's a little vial in the front of the coffee pot that shows you how much is in the reserve in the back. So when you pour the water in the back, you can see how full it is. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that little vial is the index. There's paint on the vial. It's showing the metrics of how deep that reserve is. You can distort that metric very easily by unscrewing the cap of that vial and just pouring all the water that you're putting into the machine into the vial rather than into the reserve. And when the majority of the water going into the coffee machine is going in through the vial rather than in through the reserve, the index has completely lost its ability to measure how much is in the reserve. It's become counterproductive. And that was what Mr. Bogle's prime fear was, is that the majority of money going into the market was going into index funds, and the majority of money when it came out on the reverse side was coming out of index funds, which means that profitable companies were being treated as poorly as unprofitable companies, and unprofitable companies were being treated as nicely as profitable companies.
Yeah, there is a lot of danger once too much money gets into index funds, and we're probably on the verge of that at this point. We were again on the verge of it. As a matter of fact, I think we got into it in 2000. In the late 1990s, a lot of the surge upward in the stock market that carried it to 45 times earnings, which is utterly absurd, in the S&P 500, was people pouring money into index funds through their 401ks. And when the crash, the rather impressive 50% drop in the market from 2000 to 2002 was again mainly the result of people pulling money out of S&P 500 index funds. The Christmas Eve decline this last year was largely an element of two things, and they magnify each other. One, people started pulling money out of the S&P 500 index funds before Christmas vacation. And secondly, the automated trading systems that saw the S&P 500 going down and started trading the S&P 500 negatively. They started selling out of the S&P 500. When we take an index like the S&P 500 and make it the focus of our investing, we create distortions. And eventually, those distortions get paid for, as they did in 1987. They get paid for generally suddenly and unexpectedly, and things tend to right themselves. So That's the main thing, John Bogle. But John Bogle, if we look at the fact that he founded Vanguard, there's an important thing to remember about him. There was an accidental release of his investment portfolio numbers about 10 years ago. It was immediately retracted, but it was picked up by enough news media that we could see what he was invested in. The vast majority of his money was not in S&P 500 index funds. It was in Vanguard, but it was in the funds at Vanguard that have managers. It's actively managed funds. And yes, expenses are very, very important, and the expenses should be as low as a mutual fund can make them and still be profitable. And they shouldn't be hidden, and they shouldn't be assumed that they can be very, very high prices. And they have dropped, in effect, about 60-some percent since Vanguard opened up and started becoming popular. Vanguard now is the largest mutual fund company, and they have done a good job of providing competition for everybody else. So that's the big thing that John Bogle brought to the market, I think. By the way, a little interesting side note. People get all concerned about gold and the price of gold and should I invest in gold and gold is a good thing or gold is a bad thing. Palladium, which you've probably never heard of, is trading right now. The futures, March futures, are trading for $1,318.50 an ounce, which is $25 more than gold. It was up 13% last year. It's up, it's been up, I think, 10, 15% this year already. And if you were going to trade in a precious metal, and I am not recommending you do so, palladium has been far more profitable than gold for a long time. Why am I mentioning palladium? It's actually, by the way, platinum has kind of fallen into third place among precious metals. What I'm trying to say is palladium is at the price it's at because it gets used industrially. Gold is at whatever price it is because of demand in India and China. So if you think gold is a safe bet, we've pointed out over and over again, gold is down as much as the market in the last 12 months, and gold has been steadily trending downhill for 600 years. I say steadily, the trend has been downhill for 600 years, and there's no particular reason that gold should be more or less valuable than anything else except for the mythology associated with it. So that's just a little side note that how irrational the price of gold is. There's a couple of things out there. Let me tell you something if you want to worry about things. People like to worry about things. March. Beware the Ides of March, I guess, is the thing to be very concerned about. There are several things coming up in March that have the potential to blow market values downward very extensively. One of them is the fact that we have a March deadline president has set and Chairman Xi has set for the automatic imposition of 25% tariffs on most goods imported from China. Gradually, over the last several months, and I like it when this happens, economists and chief financial officers have come around to the position that I took, which is that would be utterly disastrous to the United States economy. And even when economists make forecasts, such as at Moody's, probably the most accurate forecast I've seen so far is economy.com, Moody's, which you got to pay a bunch of money to subscribe to. But Mark Zandi there, say every time he makes a forecast for 2019, he throws a big caveat in. And the first caveat that he throws in is if those tariffs are imposed, those 25% tariffs are imposed, all bets are off, and we could get a recession this year. We could get into some serious economic difficulties, even if the tariffs were imposed for a relatively short period of time. It would cause companies across the world to need to restructure their supply chains, which would cause tremendous disruption in productivity, in production, in prices. The ramifications of it there are just beginning to sink in to CFOs and CEOs across the country and around the world. And they are not at all happy with what they see as the ramifications. The disruption in supply chains and in pricing would be disastrous to the United States economy. And I say disastrous meaning that we don't know, typically we're in a recession until about 3 to 6 months after it starts, but the economists who've been most accurate and the collective consensus of CEOs is if that tariff goes into effect, we have a very high probability in the United States of immediately entering into a self-reinforcing recession, which we wouldn't even be able to technically recognize for several months. But once it gets started, these things have to work their way out. They can't. It's not something you can go into and come right back out of again, because it would be such a huge price and supply disruption. Another thing that's coming up in March is the debt limit. The Congress and the President agreed last year to postpone the debt limit discussions and just say there is no debt limit until March of this year. But we are well over the debt limit that's going to appear in March of this year right now. We passed last year, our Congress, passed a bill, and the President signed it, that increased our deficit to an absolute record. And it is continuing to run along at that record. It is dramatically increasing our total debt of the federal government. And in March, when the bill expires that turned off the debt limit, we will be way above that debt limit. And if the members of Congress, specifically the Freedom Caucus, who have said they will block any legislation to raise the debt limit, which is very ironic considering they're the people who voted to reduce taxes and raise spending last year. When that hits, it has the potential to shut the government down again. The third thing, and when I say shut the government down, if the government stays shut down under its current regime and then continues the shutdown, that alone could put us in recession in 2019. It's a compounding effect. The longer the government is shut down, the more things don't get done, and the more money doesn't get spent, and the more contractors don't have money to spend, and the more people don't have money to spend. It becomes a pretty crucial item. Basically, if it stays shut down through the end of this month, it's going to have a significant effect on the GDP. Now, the third thing, and we're not paying much attention to it in the United States, but we should, is Brexit. The second largest financial center in the world is London. If, as we're cruising towards 70 days away, the exit of, by law, of the United Kingdom from the European Union, and there is no resolution on either side on how to fix that, and there's several possible resolutions, but they're about it right now. They're about as likely as the Democrats and the President agreeing on how to build, on whether or not to build the wall. That will cause a significant disruption in world trade. You say, okay, what's that to me? That's no big thing. It is a big thing. United States, the large United States corporations that make up the lion's share of the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index and who employ the largest single percentage of people in the United States are complex multinational corporations with supply chains and administrative chains that run through multiple countries, including China and Great Britain. Suddenly cutting those links would be like randomly, if you're driving down the highway, somebody or a squirrel underneath the hood of your car randomly cutting wires in your engine compartment.
Right.
You're probably going to realize pretty quickly that things aren't running very, very well, and you could wind up stalling and running off the road. And we really don't know all of the ramifications that could occur from any one of those three things occurring, but they're all coming in March. And all three of them had the potential to really upset the apple cart. It's not something to run away from, and I don't recommend you run away from it. But it's roughly the equivalent of if you were a government employee last year, you probably would have had no thought that your checks might suddenly cease coming. So you might not have built up a cash reserve. It's a good idea to recognize that there are some events that are very distinct possibilities that could come all together in March that could really throw the economy and the market into a tailspin. Do I think they're actually going to happen? I think we're probably going to dodge the bullet because I think the people who are involved are smarter than that. On the other hand, very frankly, I would have never thought we'd get in the position where the government has been shut down this long, and I never thought we'd be in the position where we're playing chicken with China. But these are just things to be aware of. They won't affect the long-term performance of the United States economy, but in the short term, they're dangerous, so it's good to have some reserve built up. All right, I've gone on my soliloquy long enough.
Thank you. Just thinking about there's enough stuff that we can touch on that can help explain our viewpoints outside of the United States that we can remove some of the political bias that happens. Right now, there's a political discussion going on, discussions being the lightest terminology, that makes any discussion on economics difficult because people say, I wish you guys would get off of politics. Well, politics just got into economics. They've been getting into economics for over a year. It's not normal that they do, but they're there. So when we speak the normal terminology of economics, people say, I wish you wouldn't be so political. So I'm going to remind folks of something we talked about last week and give it as a comparison to what's going on in the United States. So in Mexico last week, week before last, actually, the new president of Mexico instituted a series of changes to their oil and gas industry. Big changes. Number one, he ran on the platform of energy independence to Mexico. So
for Mexico.
For Mexico. Yeah. Mexico should, according to Mexicans, is very much like any country would want, wants to be in a place where all of their energy comes from inside Mexico. It's a strategic imperative. So one of the first things he did when he took office was slow down or cease all imports of crude oil into Mexico. This is a big deal. It's a extremely big deal if you think about it from the perspective of anything we would be talking about if the government wasn't shut down, if we didn't have a trade war looming or in action against China, this would be all we're talking about. And it gets bigger. So we've got tankers from the United States that are sitting offshore in Mexico trying to determine if they should just turn around and go back. It's with crude oil in it. So this is unrefined stuff. It's something called light sweet crude. These the names of oil, the types of oil, were developed by geologists. And light sweet is one where I think that the geologists should not be putting the substances in their mouth. But if that's how they named it that way. Light sweet crude is what we get out of the Permian Basin in the fracking operations here in Texas. We call it West Texas Intermediate. That's how it's priced. But it's the same grade as what comes out of the ground in Saudi Arabia. Only in Saudi Arabia, you basically have to sneeze at the ground and it leaks out. Now, they have other costs associated with getting oil out of the ground in Saudi Arabia. Their costs are not the cost of actually getting it out of the ground. It's the entitlement programs that they're running for the country in Saudi Arabia are a cost on the oil industry. So they need a specific price per barrel in order to be profitable there that has nothing to do with the actual cost of getting it out of the ground. In Mexico, they have something called Mayan oil. It's not light sweet. Just like in Canada, they have the Canadian tar sands. Mayan oil is not as heavy as the tar sands, but it's very heavy. In order to refine it to make gasoline, you have to add light sweet crude to it. So in an effort to become energy independent, the new president said no outside oil comes in. They only produce 56% of their own oil, one, and two, in order to make gasoline out of it, you need a gallon-for-gallon ratio of light sweet crude with the Mayan, which means that they can't get energy independent by telling people outside the country not to ship any more to them. In the middle of that, in dealing with a theft issue, micro theft issue, the gasoline pipelines that run throughout Mexico that ship much of the gasoline to the different facilities that get them out to the gas stations across the country. They've had micro thefts of those pipelines over 2018, so this is a one-year period, that amounted to more than $2 billion, billion with a B, $2 billion of theft of gasoline from micro thefts. People show up and find a normal coupling point, a testing point that they use to access the pipeline for repairs and so on. And they just hook up a pump there and give all their friends gasoline, and then they unhook it and they go home, and they may come back tomorrow and do it. So the president of Mexico shut down the pipelines. So in Mexico right now, in an effort to become energy independent, they're having trouble shipping food into Mexico City. There are people that are leaving the core of Mexico City to leave the city to get food. This would normally be top news. It's not top news right now. And from an external perspective, we in the United States looking at Mexico and going, well, that is not how you get to be energy independent. You don't just shut stuff off if you need it. You figure out ways of producing it yourself. That seems pretty apparent no matter your political party in the United States when looking at Mexico. Except that in the United States, we're doing essentially the same thing with the tariffs on steel and aluminum. If it's for negotiation purposes to say we need better prices or we need a better deal on trade period with these countries, it's understandable. But if it's being used as a strategic purpose of making us independent in steel or independent in aluminum or independent on any of the other areas with tariffs on it, it's not going to function that way. That is not how you get to be energy independent. You make it profitable for companies to produce the thing that you wish to be independent in.
Generally speaking, when governments get involved and try to shape economies, it fails. The prime example is the Soviet Union, which was right. The extreme shaper of its own economy and ultimately blew up. Financially, economically, we didn't defeat them militarily. They defeated themselves economically. They were a centrally planned economy. And to give an example, I don't want to be too negative about what's going on between us and China, but I'm going to have to say, yes, the issues with China, particularly the trade policy with regard to intellectual property rights, needed to be addressed and certainly did. However, the European Union has exactly the same problem with China that we do. And as a result, had we negotiated with the European Union and say, let's find a way to gradually ratchet up the pressure on China so that the Chinese will change their behavior, that would work. Because the two big importers from China are the United States and the European Union. Now, this is one of the great ironies of the tariffs that we've got against China so far. 2018 broke all previous records for imports from China, and it was the year during which we had tariffs on imports from China. Here's the biggest irony that I can think of in the world. The total exports from China, the trade imbalance, I should say, with China, the exports over imports, declined last year for the rest of the world, but it increased for the United States. And it was only the United States that put tariffs on goods out of China. You know, Jake was talking about the fact that the Mexican president's decision to stop oil imports is actually damaging their internal economy rather than...
It's damaging the industry that he was trying to protect.
Yes, and the same thing is true in the United States. A really great irony is that the fact that we declared effectively a trade war on China caused the Chinese populace to be concerned because we were and still are China's biggest customer. They were concerned their economy was going to slow down, and in fact has slowed down. It had nothing, next to nothing to do with our actions on tariffs, by the way.
Though that the results of that may come in later. Right now, the slowdown had nothing to do with it.
Yeah, they actually increased their imports 18% to the United States last year, or their exports to the United States. But the Chinese consumer, which is where the Chinese were trying to focus, the Chinese government was focusing on, let's cut out dependence on export. Let's try to get our consumers to buy more stuff. In the process of the trade war, the consumers got scared and stopped buying so much of their own manufactured goods, which left the manufactured goods in surplus in China, which meant that the people who manufacture the stuff in China
could charge less for them.
Well, they did. They started charging less because they have all this stuff there that they couldn't sell internally to China. So they lowered their prices to the United States, more than 10%, by the way, which offsets the tariffs, and started selling it to the United States. And so we've gotten basically an avalanche of imports from China because we instituted tariffs and started a trade war with China. And you may think, well, that's a one-off deal. And actually, it's not. It's happened all over the world. Every time tariffs get imposed, we get unexpected results, and it becomes very, very complex to try to figure out in advance what these things are going to do. The one thing we can say with some degree of certainty, well, with a very high degree of certainty, is that throughout history, trade wars have damaged both sides, and it's not a matter of who wins and who loses. It's a matter of who loses the most. And at the present, very frankly, we're losing the trade war. We are being more damaged than China is. This is not a good position to be in. And it's one of those things where I'm not trying to criticize the president. I think his understanding of economics is at least as good as the average person. I'm simply saying this is something to be aware of. Simplistic answers in economics, almost without exception, don't work.
Right. And this is important to know because you just said we are losing the trade war with China. That doesn't mean China's winning.
Right.
This is something explicit that you should understand about trade wars. The way you win, put air quotes around that word, please, a trade war is by losing less than your opponent. There is no way you can win long-term a trade war and make lots of money in the process. People doubt that. If you're in a trade relationship, as a small business, this is the best way to understand it, and you have a normal customer, and you feel like that customer isn't paying you enough, and you institute higher prices that don't have anything to do with the product that you're creating on that customer, you're just as likely to drive that customer to another purchase location as you are to actually increase it. And the more acrimony you use, the more negative emotion you give when you're raising a price to your customer, the more likely they are to go to someone else. When it comes to a trade war with China, what we're saying to China, this is, let me synopsize the message we're sending to China, the one we want to send to China. This is from the president. We want you to open up and buy from us more and not charge us as little as you're charging us for the goods that you're giving us. We want you to raise your prices on the goods that you're selling to us, and we want you to buy more from us. That seems on the surface to be a pretty nice thing to say. Hey, we want to pay you more for what you're sending us. That's what tariffs are. And at the same time, we want you to buy from us. But the negativity in the message causes the reverse result, where they're going to charge us less, as they are, which means we'll buy more from them, and they're going to buy less from us, which is the opposite of the intention. You can look at this from a small business perspective, and it's pretty clear. And that's where we are on the macro level, only the decisions aren't being made at a profitability line. They're being made way, way beyond any profitability, just saying on numbers that don't really make sense, how are we winning or losing? Because if we looked at just profitability of companies, our companies are more profitable than theirs for the most part.
Well, our nation is more profitable than theirs.
Right. So on that surface, even before the tariffs, we're winning.
Now, technically, either now or sometime in the near future, the Chinese economy will be larger than the United States economy. That's a given. However, if you divide the number of people,
the per capita,
they are the per capita
fraction.
GDP in China is a fraction of that in Mexico. I mean, China is still a poor country. It's just a very large poor country, and it's a very large poor country with a very low birth rate. And very, very low immigration, meaning very few people coming into the country, like next to none, and a lot of people trying to leave the country.
China,
long-term, is not a threat to the United States. Now,
the per capita GDP, that means if you took all of their GDP and separated by person, the per capita GDP in China is $8,826 a year last year.
What is it for the United States? 54?
59,000. So
yeah, 59,000 in the United States.
If you think that's a huge difference. 8,800 versus 59,000.
To give you a little bit of reference on this, and I think again, failure to study history and read the good history books is a problem. We got very upset about 20 years ago because Japan was stealing all of our stuff. I remember a big stink over the fact that the VCR player was invented in the United States, but none of them were made in the United States. They were being made at that point principally in Japan, and gradually it moved to China and India, and then it disappeared. Well, it's because the VCR player is no longer in use.
Yeah, we're not going out to rent VHS tapes very often anymore.
I'll make a prediction. The cheap labor, first off, we need the cheap labor from China. That's one of the things that the economists and the CFOs are recognizing. If we can't get it from China, we'll go to India. We'll go to Southeast Asia to get it. But we need the cheap labor to keep the things that you and I buy on a regular basis inexpensive enough we can afford to have them, or we will wind up with a lower standard of living in the United States. Now, I'll also tell you that all this stuff that's being made with cheap labor in China today, 10 years from now, will be made by robotics in the United States if we still need it.
Yeah.
And that is a long-term trend.
It's the same as the VCR player. Is that you've got to have an understanding of the shifts in technology to mm-hmm. understand the labor market.
For instance, if today internal combustion engines, and many of them are made in Mexico, and ship back to the United States. We make the parts here. We send them to Mexico. They come back. Actually, sometimes the parts are made in China, shipped to the United States. Then the parts are shipped. There's other stuff put on them here. And then they go to Mexico where they're assembled and they're shipped back to the United States. That's why I say a 25% tariff would totally disrupt the system. To bring a little anecdote in here on what this means, we had a jump in industrial production of 1.1% in December, which means we're either going into a gigantic boom or something weird happened. I'll tell you exactly what happened now that we've examined it. The fear of future tariffs caused overproduction of this model year of the major automobile manufacturers in the United States because they wanted to get the stuff out of China. They wanted to get order from China. It's one of the reasons, by the way, we broke all records for trade imbalances. Because they wanted to get the stuff ordered from China and delivered here so they could send it to Mexico so they could bring it back from Mexico for this model year.
Before the prices went up.
And we will see a sag in industrial production going down the road without regard to what happens to tariffs, simply because the tariffs distorted what companies are doing. In other words, they did something very inefficient that's going to hurt their profitability because of the threat of tariffs. This is the kind of thing that can disrupt an economic situation that's in delicate balance, which ours is right now.
Yeah, there is a very simple statement that I can make here, and I'm not going to do it. We'll be complicated instead. If we look at the future of the automobile market, it's not internal combustion.
Right, and that's the other thing I was going to bring up.
Yeah, and it's very clear. It's not because we don't like internal combustion any more than we don't like coal. When coal was king, it's because it was the cheapest form of energy. It's not king anymore. It's no longer the cheapest form of energy. There are other costs components to coal that weren't there before as well. Like it was okay to pump the smoke from the coal burning up into the atmosphere as much as you wanted for a very long time. It's not okay anymore. People like to live without emphysema, and that's an important factor. So that's a cost, and unfortunately that's a cost that's generally applied by government. But that's what government's for, is to make certain things safer. There's costs associated with energy. And the internal combustion engine is, by its nature, extremely inefficient. External combustion is much more efficient, which is why you've got the turbines that run train engines. Now, it requires a larger space. Internal combustion, we have waste heat. If you are at all familiar with energy, you recognize that waste heat is waste energy. We're throwing away a lot of the energy that was in that gasoline. We have to fight to keep our engines not too hot. That's what the radiator is. So the future of transportation is in a more efficient mode. Well, what is that going to be? Well, right now, we already know something that's coming along to replace it, electric motors, because batteries are becoming far more efficient and we can use the much lower cost of natural gas at a power plant. That's a much lower cost for energy than the cost inside the engine. It's like trying to power your house with a gasoline power generator. You're going to spend a lot more money doing it that way than just being hooked up to the grid.
I don't think a lot of people have recognized it. In the European Union, it will be illegal to sell, to manufacture and sell a new internal combustion driven car 6 years from now.
Right. And in the United States, it's going to be a market force that changes that. And I'm much more willing to accept the market force. Yeah, and in California, there's going to be a governmental force. I'm much more willing to accept the market force. But if it comes either way, we look at it and say, for efficiency purposes, the car parts that are being manufactured, the vast majority of them that are being manufactured in Mexico, that are being manufactured outside the United States for cars, are parts that won't even be in cars in 10 years.
Well, one of the things, again, that came up is the parts, many of the parts for cars are actually manufactured in China.
Right.
They're shipped to the United States. We put them together in subunits. We send the subunits, like the engine itself, to Mexico, where it's assembled into a complete vehicle. But if you look at where things like that are manufactured, when we moved the manufacturing, used to be the manufacturing was here, and then the manufacturing went to Mexico. Now it's gone to China. That means that at some point in the near future, almost without exception,
it's going to go away.
It won't be manufactured by anybody because nobody will want it.
Right. One thing to make clear in this conversation before someone panics and thinks we're saying something we're not, the technology for electric cars that we're talking about is not the stuff that's on the street today. That's got a 200-mile, or if you get really expensive and spend $100,000 on your automobile, you got a 250-mile radius, and you get to recharge over a two-hour period. So if you're taking a road trip, this is a way of lengthening the time on that road trip tremendously and plotting it around where you can recharge. The technology we're talking about isn't even the lithium-ion battery. There's a fluoride battery that has just been discovered that has 10 times the energy density of a lithium ion. If you've got 250 miles on a lithium ion battery, the same size battery with the fluoride instead of lithium ion, you're going 2,500 miles on one charge.
There's an irony there. Now, the irony is, you know, when we killed the gases that were damaging the refrigerant gases,
right,
that were damaging the ozone, we plunged a section of
chlorofluorocarbons.
The fluoride mines in northern Mexico collapsed. I mean, they're financially collapsed.
Yeah, not physically collapsed. Yeah.
And the people around them suddenly tried to migrate to the United States. That was the beginning, by the way, one of the beginnings of the mass migration to the United States.
Right.
the irony is the fluoride, if the fluoride battery goes into mass production,
there won't be any workers left there to do it.
No, the point is that it will suddenly cause a reverse migration probably back to Mexico. When governments get involved trying to solve major problems like this, it generally, first off, exacerbates the problem. And secondly, it is a problem that could, it will probably, the market forces will solve it themselves in the near future.
Now, there is a statement that I can make here as well. Governments have a purpose.
Oh, they
do. Our government has a real purpose. Law enforcement, safety, the FDA, making sure that we have food and drugs that aren't going to mess us up.
Don't forget defending the country.
Defending the country, not just defending the country, but determining when we need to defend or attack another country for reasons that aren't necessarily based on defense. That's a real thing, because there are some real bad people out there. At least by our cultural standard, their cultural standard, they think we're the bad people. By definition, that means that we need to have an armed force ready to defend us or ready to attack them if they are taking stances that are against us. That's important. Our government has a role, and the role is traditionally in the United States, the governmental role has been to shepherd the pathways of trade. To keep trade flowing and open and try not to interfere. And in certain cases, that has meant invading and toppling governments. And just ask Guatemala how many times we've toppled their government over banana trade. This is an important factor.
By the way, I don't think
it's moral or ethical, but it's a decent use of a governmental force.
Guatemala is the banana republic.
Yes, that is why when someone says it's like a banana republic, they're referring to Guatemala. so this concept of trade and the government being there in the United States to shepherd the pathways of trade, when our government starts getting involved in the trade without a shift in priorities anywhere else, it causes confusion. What's more, it's amateurish. Other governments have been involved in trade and practicing it for a long time. China's one of them. China's government is intricately involved in their trade. They have party members, mandatory party member positions in every corporation at every level of the corporation. That all their job is to make sure that the company is doing what the government wants them to do.
For whatever it's worth, I want to say something. We do believe that it is appropriate to exercise pressure on Japan, although we think it'd be better if it's coordinated with the European Union.
On Japan?
Not on Japan. On China, for their industrial espionage. Their
nation
state is clearly involved in industrial espionage and stealing U.S. trade secrets and stealing U.S. technology. No question about it. The position that we've taken, and we take this for a reason, is because it has the potential to damage your investment portfolios and damage our economy, is that swatting, if you've got cockroaches, there's a reason you've got cockroaches in your house. And one of the reasons is you're feeding them.
Yeah.
And if you clean your house up and bring in a professional to narrowly put something down that will kill the cockroaches and not the people in the house.
And check your neighbors, too, in the process.
Right, and not make the people sick in the house. That is an appropriate thing. To get a sledgehammer.
Say, we got a cockroach problem. I'm not calling the exterminator. We're handling it ourselves.
With a sledgehammer. You're probably going to do more damage to the house. Now, that's not to say that we're against President Trump. It's not to say that we're against the Republicans. We simply say that one of the things we need to be aware of as citizens of the United States, as investors, is the potential for damage. Now, let me tell you the other side of this, the good news. I think the United States economy is going to do reasonably well this year. We could be kicked into a premature recession by what we call socio-political activities. If that happens, the trick is don't panic. Don't bail out of the market. Stay invested. Matter of fact, if you have extra money, if a crash occurs, that'd be a good time to get in. And the reason I say this is we have an institutional system that's very effective and very efficient and does a wonderful job. Do we have commercials yet today?
Yes.
Okay, well, then we have to break for commercials. And it will come out on the other side better than we see today and more healthy than we see today, and we're convinced that that's true.
Now, we're going to play some commercials. We're only going to have a few seconds when we come back, so we appreciate you listening, and we'll be back on the other side.
This is you over 30 years ago.
Are we there yet? Are we there yet?
And this is your mom when you drive her back from therapy.
Are we there yet? Are we there yet? Are we there yet?
Roles change without us noticing, and in your new role, we help you help. AARP gives you the information to help care for your mom so that you can have patience with her, just like she did with you. Visit aarp.org/caregiving or call 1-877-333-5885 to get practical health and wellness tips to provide even better care for your loved one.
Are we there yet?
Remember, visit aarp.org/caregiving. AARP, we help you help. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
And now, a message from the American Migraine Foundation.
It's an absolute nightmare. I was terrified. It was like, your head's going to explode.
Migraine is a disabling disease.
Just all of a sudden couldn't see.
Migraine has ruined my life.
Absolutely terrifying.
There's pain that does not stop.
It's a throbbing, pulsing, banging, hammering feeling in your head.
36 million Americans suffer.
I started getting migraines around 5 years old.
Just takes over everything.
I feel trapped by migraine.
It hurts like my head's gonna like fall off.
And the whole world around you stops.
My world has gotten small.
You feel like the world's closing in on you. There's nothing you can do.
I had spent a year housebound.
It's like you're trapped in your head. There's no escaping it. You can't leave your body.
Don't suffer alone. Make your move against migraine. Visit AmericanMigraineFoundation.org to find help, learn more, and get connected.
Looking for a stable investment with a great rate of return? Stash your cash in certificates from PenFed Credit Union. Right now, PenFed is offering rates that are 3 to 6 times higher than the national average. It's easy to open an account online, by phone, or in a nearby PenFed branch. For more information, visit PenFed.org today. That's PenFed.org. National average based on information sourced from Bankrate as of December 19th. Federally insured by NCUA.
It only takes a minute to find out if you may have prediabetes. And you can do it at doihaveprediabetes.org. But you're probably not going to, are you? Kids, work, listening to the radio. You're busy, which is great because busy people can't get prediabetes. Oh my, I read that wrong. They can.
Should have worn my glasses.
So visit doihaveprediabetes.org and take a short test, because prediabetes can be reversed.
Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.
It's Thursday night, and you're grabbing drinks with some friends. Started off with a pitcher for the table, which quickly becomes two. There's pool. And there's the photo booth.
All right, everybody, squeeze in. Say cheese!
Followed naturally by an order of wings. And another.
Can we get some extra ranch sauce?
Then there's the ceremonial nightcap.
So what are we doing this weekend?
And lastly, it's back to the car, which, if you're buzzed...
6-8-8-9-8-10-4.
Could be the most expensive night of your life. Getting pulled over for buzz driving could cost you around $10,000 in fines, legal fees, and increased insurance rates. Nothing kills a buzz like getting pulled over for buzz driving, because buzz driving is drunk driving. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
And we're back for just a moment with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And we're out of time for this second hour and for today, January 19th, 2019.
If you'd like to contact us off the air, we do give personalized investment advice, fiduciary level to high net worth people.
And the telephone number is 254-947-1111.
You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can read our newsletter and listen to podcasts, that sort of thing. You can also email us at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. Until next week, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.